This is the EMDocs.net podcast with Britt Long and Manny Singh. We bring you high-yield content about what you're seeing every day in the ED. We see patients with a sore throat on a fairly routine basis. We've already covered one life-threatening cause of a sore throat, and that was Ludwig's angina. Today, we're going to be looking at epiglottitis. Let's start off with some epidemiology. Overall, the incidence of pediatric epiglottitis has been declining, primarily because of the Haemophilus influenza B vaccination. The incidence in pediatric patients is now about 0.5 per 100,000. In adults, the incidence is anywhere between 1 to 4 per 100,000. The most common patient population affected are male patients between the ages of 42 to 48 years. The most common bacteria are going to be staph and strep species. The infectious form is going to cause epiglottitis through invasion of the epithelial layer or through bacteremia. There are some other etiologies like viral and fungal infections, a foreign body ingestion, thermal injury, graft versus host disease, and some others like Costa congestions. All of these conditions result in edema and accumulation of inflammatory cells within that potential space between the epiglottic cartilage and the epithelial layer. This causes swelling of the epiglottis and the supraglottic structures. Infection and inflammation rapidly worsen because there's an extensive lymphatic and vascular network surrounding these structures. However, the subglottic region is not typically affected because there's tightly bound epithelium at the vocal cord level. Now let's talk about how these patients are going to present. There are a couple major differences between pediatric patients and adult patients. This primarily comes down to anatomical differences in airway shape and diameter. The pediatric epiglottis has more pliant cartilage and is more anterior and superior compared to the rigid epiglottis and airway of adults. Also, the narrowest portion of the pediatric airway is the subglottis. In adults, it's the glottis. Kids are more commonly going to come in with tripod positioning, fever, and stridor that progressively worsens over hours. Adults are more commonly going to present with severe sore throat, dysphagia, and drooling in a subacute manner, usually over days. Nearly all patients with epiglottitis who are adults are going to come in with sore throat. Fever can occur in anywhere between 26 to 90% of cases, but only 50 to 65% will present with drooling or difficulty handling secretions. 50 to 80% will also present with a muffled voice. There are some physical exam features that can help us with the diagnosis. The first one is the absence of findings. Up to 90% of adults with epiglottitis will have a completely normal oropharyngeal exam. If you have a patient, they've been seen multiple times for a sore throat, or they have pain out of proportion to exam, then you need to think about epiglottitis. Also think about the condition in patients with severe pain with palpation of the external larynx or the hyoid bone. There are some other maneuvers that you can do to help you take a look at the epiglottis. Basically, what you're going to do is place a Macintosh laryngoscope blade on the patient's tongue and have the patient try to speak in a high-pitched tone. This is going to raise the supraglottic structures a couple centimeters. The epiglottis might be visible at that point. Don't perform this in the patient who's in extremis or they're having difficulty tolerating the procedure. You potentially can use nebulized or viscous lidocaine here. We already mentioned this, but up to 90% of adult patients with epiglottitis are going to have a normal oropharynx. You need to have a differential when this occurs. Some of these conditions include Costa congestion, epiglottitis, a foreign body, Lemierre syndrome, parapharyngeal space infection, retropharyngeal abscess, tracheitis, and then potentially early Ludwig's angina. Let's talk about the ED evaluation. Labs really aren't going to help us much here. Your CBC is going to be nonspecific. Patients might have an elevated white blood cell count. Cultures from the site also aren't going to be super helpful. Thankfully, we do have some imaging tests that can provide important clues to the diagnosis. The first one is going to be the lateral neck radiograph. This is going to be performed with the patient upright. We're going to be looking for the thumbprint sign, which has a sensitivity and specificity of around 90%, and then the vallecula sign. The thumbprint sign is a swollen epiglottis. The vallecula sign occurs when the normal deep airspace from the base of the tongue to the epiglottis is shallow or even absent. Unfortunately, lateral neck radiographs have a false negative rate of around 32%. So all that means is that while they're helpful in confirming the diagnosis, you can't use them to rule it out. CT is also potentially helpful, especially when obtained with IV contrast. The sensitivity and specificity are both over 90%. The problem with CT is that it requires the patient to lie supine, which could make their airway and their respiratory status worse. Ultrasound has actually demonstrated some promise here. You're going to use a linear transducer in the transverse position at the level of the thyrohyoid membrane, halfway between the hyoid bone and the thyroid cartilage. You can then measure the epiglottic thickness and the width at that membrane. Early studies have shown that the anterior-posterior diameter of the midpoint and the lateral epiglottis might be larger compared to healthy controls, but we need further data. You might also see the alphabet P sign, which has been described in several case reports. All right, so we've looked at presentation and evaluation. Let's talk a little bit about management. The treatment priorities are going to be airway assessment and intervention if necessary, and then also antibiotics. These are going to be a mainstay. Appropriate antibiotics would be something like ceftriaxone or ampicillin sulbactam with vancomycin for MRSA coverage. If the patient has a severe penicillin allergy, then you should provide levofloxacin. If the patient is immunocompromised or you're concerned for pseudomonas, then you could use cefepime or piperacillin tazobactam. Metronidazole is not really necessary anymore based on the current literature, which suggests that anaerobes are not associated with epiglottitis. There are a couple adjunct therapies that you can potentially try here. The first one is going to be nebulized epinephrine. This has been looked at in adults with epiglottitis to assist with airway bronchodilation and potentially reduce edema. However, the data suggesting improved patient-centered outcomes are lacking and it's controversial. If you have a patient and they're in extremis, they're in respiratory distress, it's potentially worth a shot. You do need to be careful with using nebulized epinephrine in kids. In pediatric patients with epiglottitis, it's been associated with laryngospasm, agitation, and then further deterioration. The second adjunct treatment is going to be steroids. Steroids are thought to reduce airway inflammation and edema and potentially improve the patient's airway. Anywhere between 20 to 83% of patients with epiglottitis will receive steroids at some point during their hospital stay. However, when we look at the retrospective data concerning the use of steroids in epiglottitis, there really hasn't been an improvement in ICU length of stay, hospital length of stay, or even intubation. Despite the absence of improved patient-centered outcomes with steroids, if that patient is in extremis, then a dose of dexamethasone 10 mg IV or methylprednisolone 125 mg IV is probably not a bad idea. Finally, let's talk a little bit about airway. There are some factors that predict the need for airway intervention. These include subjective dyspnea, a history of diabetes, rapid symptom progression, stridor, drooling, tachypnea, and then a couple imaging findings like supraglottic edema extension and epiglottic abscess. When we look at airway interventions, intubation rates range between 9 and 50% in adults with epiglottitis. Classically, we would send these patients to the OR for a fiber optic bronchoscopy with potential tracheostomy. If the patient does need airway intervention, then you need to think about this as a very difficult airway, and it's all hands on deck. The right call is to speak with your ENT and anesthesia colleagues and get them on board early. The best place for this patient's airway is in a controlled setting. That might be the OR in academic settings or tertiary hospitals, but you might be it in a community shop. Thankfully, our airway tools and techniques have drastically changed in the last couple of years. We now have the flexible intubating endoscope and then also video laryngoscopy. Awake nasotracheal flexible intubating endoscopy is still the preferred method, but you can also use awake video laryngoscopy. Keep in mind that if you have a patient in extremis and you think they need an airway, don't reach for that LMA or another supraglottic airway device. The device won't seat correctly and it can potentially worsen edema and then precipitate further airway occlusion. That's enough on airway. Let's talk about some take-home points for your next shift. Epiglottitis is now more common in adults than children. The presentation of epiglottitis in pediatric patients includes that patient with fever, tripod positioning, stridor, and acute respiratory distress. This is different from adults. Adults are going to present more subacutely with severe progressive odynephagia and dysphagia. They may also have fevers. Don't rely on a normal oropharyngeal exam to exclude the diagnosis. Lateral neck x-rays can be an initial helpful test, but you can't use these to rule out the disease. CT is a better imaging modality, but it requires the patient to lie supine, which could worsen their respiratory status. Treatment includes first airway assessment and potentially intervention if necessary, and then antibiotics. Speak with your ENT and anesthesia colleagues early. Steroids and nebulized epinephrine can reduce airway edema and improve patient symptoms. However, they haven't demonstrated any improvement in patient-centered outcomes. Airway intervention should be performed in a controlled setting with multiple adjuncts available. Awake intubation with nasotracheal, flexible intubating endoscopy is the preferred tool of choice, followed by video laryngoscopy. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Stay safe and healthy, everyone.